This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Donald Trump has a fraught relationship with the media, to say the least. This week, CNN filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration over their ban on the reporter Jim Acosta. Last week, the president openly attacked three female African-American reporters, including this interaction with CNN's Abby Phillip.
What a stupid question that is. What a stupid question. But I watch you a lot. You ask a lot of stupid questions.
Yeah, that's your president, Donald Trump, who has made no secret of his disdain for many members of the press. This latest series of comments highlights what analysts are calling an ongoing trend, and that is that the president singles out women and minorities. It's one of the topics we'll talk about today on Back Channel, a recurring series connecting culture and context. Later, we will review a new Netflix rom-com, the new LeBron James docuseries Shut Up and Dribble, and the film The Hate U Give. Also pay tribute to two recently deceased artists, playwright Intasaki Shange and trumpeter Roy Hargrove. And joining me for that and more, popular culture experts Natalie Bullock-Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie's a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State University. Natalie, welcome back.
Thank you, Frank.
Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. He is an author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Hello, Mark.
Hey, Frank.
Talk about this. Over the course of the last few days, Donald Trump singled out three African-American female journalists, Abby Phillip, Yamiche Alcindor, and April Ryan, accused them of asking a stupid question, a racist question, and of being a loser. Natalie, what do you make of this?
I think that all of the offensive nature of the fact that the leader of the free world is addressing female journalists in this way. And it, of course, the fact that they're black is, you know, is just par for the course. But I think that it really reveals the depth of this president's ability to gaslight. This is what he has been doing from the beginning of his presidency. And I see the impact of that gaslighting in the response of the women, of these journalists. And they're feeling the need when they were asked about these moments with him, you know, and what happened and what were they trying to do. They all try and defend themselves. And I just think it's ridiculous because each and every one of them had a legitimate question that they wanted to ask.
Mark?
You know, we can always be offended by the president and what has been his contentious relationship with media. We can talk about the specificity of his interactions with black and Latino journalists. But this isn't just a Donald Trump problem. One of the reasons why he could isolate Ms. Ryan and Ms. Phillips and Ms. Alcindor is because that isolation reflects what the isolation looks like in these newsrooms.
That's right.
The fact that they are minorities and few and far between in the newsrooms gets just reproduced amongst the White House press corps. If there were 15, you know, black and Latino reporters in that room, it wouldn't have been so easy for him to be able to pick and choose the women that he chose to pick and choose and attack.
But it's theater, too. I mean, it seems to me, on the one hand, we know this president is going to deflect questions, legitimate questions. Is your acting attorney general going to calm the Mueller investigation? We want to know what you plan to do. That's what you ask a president. That's what we do in this business. You're branding yourself nationalist. Does this fuel the fire? All these are legitimate questions. And we know he has to deflect those because of the implications about him. But the theater, the finger wagging, the gesturing, the ways in which he talks to women, you know, embodying blackness and femaleness,
right.
That's
for,
powerful theater for his audience.
For folks, yes,
that,
for
he
his
doesn't,
base,
right.
Exactly.
Folks that he doesn't see having any real social capital or political capital in that room, right?
Yeah.
There's not an army of them. You know, someone made the joke on Twitter, you know, all of these news organizations should just send, you know, all of their black reporters so that he can't pick and choose folks. But the fact of the matter is they simply don't even have those bodies in their newsrooms to be able to do that.
I mean, I think that's a good point. Let's listen to a clip now from April Ryan, who's a reporter for American Urban Radio Networks, contributor to CNN. Trump called her a loser last week and later mentioned her name as one of the other members of the press corps whose press credentials he might revoke. Let's listen.
I guess at this point I'm numb to it. It's been 2 years of the same thing, but now it's open. It's openly said by the President of the United States. You know, there's been efforts to silence me in the briefing room. There have been efforts to discredit me. We follow the U.S. Constitution. We have the utmost respect and reverence for the highest office in the land. It's sacred. The president is right. There is sanctity there. And one of the reasons is because life and death is in the tongue and in the pen there. This is a serious space and place, and we take our job seriously. And to be called a loser by the president of the United States, I think back about the First Amendment, freedom of the press. He is challenging the Constitution when he says that.
CNN political analyst April Ryan talking to Wolf Blitzer about Donald Trump calling her a loser. I'm with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. So it's a little bit about what you were saying, Natalie. I mean, first of all, you have to sort of defend yourself. But on the other hand, taking the high road here and saying, no, no, let's remind you, this is our job. And if anybody is disparaging and dishonoring the presidency, it is indeed Donald Trump with his behavior.
Yeah, but it seems like it's almost like, it's like shouting in, in a tornado. Like, nobody is really hearing it. It only goes so far with this administration. It really has no impact ultimately.
But getting back to what you were saying, Mark, I mean, the fact is there are these silos. Obviously, Donald Trump is talking to the 40% or fewer that in the United States who still support him. But there are other ways in which this theater can work. Fox News signed on to the lawsuit that CNN is filing to get Acosta's credentials back. Is there a way in which this theater is having a different impact in different audiences?
I'm sure even those news outlets that ostensibly are supportive of Donald Trump's politics are finding it problematic, his relationship with the press. It's just simply unprecedented, at least in this kind of electronic media moment that we're in. You know, we don't necessarily have a record of how contentious that relationship might have been 150 years ago. But in this kind of television and cable television moment, what is happening with Donald Trump is pretty much unprecedented.
Also, we should point out that one of the things he talked about in these disparaging comments was that his poll numbers among African-American voters was high. Let us, for the record, say his poll numbers are very low.
Yeah,
that 14%,
anywhere between 12 and 14% among credible polling agencies. And then, of course, there's Rasmussen, which has got him over the top. He should be president for life, according to those poll figures. Today on The State of Things, it is Back Channel with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal, and we're talking about that on The State of Things. Let's switch gears here. I want to talk about the loss of an artist. We'll talk about two artists, but Intozake Shange died last month at the age of 70, best known for her play For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide, When the Rainbow Is Enough. I want to listen to a clip from the Broadway cast recording of that production.
She's been dead so long, clothed in silence so long she doesn't know the sound of her own voice. Her infinite beauty. She's half notes scattered without rhythm, no tune. Sing her sighs. Sing the song of her possibilities. Sing a righteous gospel, the making of a melody. And let her be born. Let her be born. And handle warmly. I'm outside Chicago, and this is for colored girls who have considered suicide but are moving to the ends of their own rainbows.
From the 1976 Broadway recording of playwright Intozake Shange's For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide. And I'm talking about it with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. And Natalie, you first saw that performed when you were in college, right? What impact did that have on you?
It didn't have the impact that I'd like to say it did. I mean, I had never seen a play that was written in the way that For Colored Girls is, as a choreo poem. And I'd never seen a play that was all Black women. So that I remember. That was memorable for me. But I have to say that in lamenting Intozake Shange's passing, part of what I lament is that I did not know more about her, that I had not been exposed to her brilliance earlier and to her books and writings and poems. You know, that was not my experience. And it really wasn't until I was a little older, actually in my late 20s, when I encountered Lillian, which is a novel that she wrote, And that was really the only interaction or engagement that I had with her writing. And I really regret that.
Mark, tell us more about her.
I mean, she was amazing. I mean, she first staged for Colored Girls in the San Francisco Bay Area in 1974. It was coming at that moment where black feminism was kind of bubbling up into the mainstream. And for some time, I mean, really, Shangay was the face of black feminism. You know, before we knew who a bell hooks was or Michelle Wallace or any of these women, you know, Shangay was there. I mean, many of the folks who have followed after her, you know, aptly described her as a beast, right? A beast of nature in terms of what she was able to produce. You know, like Natalie, I was a college freshman at SUNY Fredonia, spring of 1984, when I saw my first production of Four Colored Girls. What I remember about it was that these were seven women in the cast who were my schoolmates, who I knew.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But they were immediately transformed by Shangay's words. I go some 20 years forward, and my colleague Tommy DeFrance and I co-taught the Introduction to African American Studies course at Duke in 2013. And one of the books we chose to teach was For Colored Girls, and we did a stage reading for the class. And for me, it was remarkable, one, how powerful the text was still for me 30 years later, but being able to see a younger generation of students also be transformed by those words. I actually now have my mother's first edition copy of it, you know, that's on my shelf in my office.
Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown, it's Back Channel on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. There's more just ahead. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Back Channel today, our recurring series connecting culture and context. And still with me, popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie, a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State University. Mark is a professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. And before the break, we started talking about the life and legacy of playwright and poet Itosaki Shange. Let's listen to a clip of her talking about her poetry.
Writing a poem from the exhilaration of dance is an exquisite experience. I could take from a movement and go write a poem, but the poem would be totally different than if I had just been sitting around my apartment.
Playwright and poet Itosaki Shange, in an interview recorded for Barnard College in 2014, she passed away last month at the age of 70, talking about her legacy with Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown. Mark, Shange's For Colored Girls was the second play by an African-American woman to be produced on Broadway. But talk about this. You talked about her being really a guiding light for black feminism. And she was not well received among other black artists, male artists at the time, right?
Oh, there's no question. I mean, when you think about the work of Shangay in the 70s, Alice Walker's work coming up to something like The Color Purple in 1982, Michelle Wallace's book on the myth of the black superwoman, that stuff was real. And the kind of animus that was directed at Shangay and Michelle Wallace and Alice Walker by men like Ishmael Reed and others was very real. And I think for, at least for me as a 18 and 19-year-old, and not quite knowing how to parse those distinctions, you know, it literally took for me 20 years of reading black feminist scholarship.
Well, Amiri Baraka.
You had a kind of male-dominated black arts movement that in many ways the black feminist movement was very critical of, right? Whether we're talking about the Combahee River Collective, whether we're talking about the work of people like Audre Lorde and Barbara Smith and literary theorist Barbara Christian. I mean, that stuff was very much real. Joan Morgan tells this wonderful story in her first book, When Chickenheads Come Home to Roost, about her mother going to see For Colored Girls on Broadway and wanting her 10-year-old, wanting her mother to take her, but her mother instead took her father. Right. And she was upset about that, yeah. But she's writing about it, you know, some 30 years later, reflecting on the fact it was probably an important intervention for her father to go see that play, you know, at that particular time.
Yeah. Well, and talk about consciousness raising. I mean, it's interesting to hear Shange herself talk about her as a young girl going to the movies or not with her mother and how things had changed for her in that period of time.
The first movie I saw in color that made an impact on me was Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, which was a Disney film. And my mother didn't take me for a long time, or what I thought was a long time. And I kept asking her, why not? She said, because Walt Disney doesn't like color people. I said, what is that? What does Snow White have to do with color people, Mommy? And she said, everything you do has to do with you being colored, and we're not going to see Snow White till they have the color day at the movie. We just ain't going. I said, oh my God.
Playwright and poet Ndzazike Shange, in a 2010 interview with Real Black, the artist passed away last month at the age of 70. And, you know, it reminds me of what you were saying, too, Natalie, the idea that, you know, you sort of didn't quite grasp it all in the moment. And she's somebody, obviously, who had evolved, and you see that evolution in her work. And then the power it has now, 30 years later, still.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I do think that she is kind of an unsung heroine. I know that there are people who, you know, in feminist spaces and literary spaces who, you know, celebrate and laud her for the brilliant person, artist that she was. But I think that she is not Alice Walker when you think about, you know, the connection that we make with her body of work and who she was.
Let's turn now to a new Netflix rom-com, Napoli Ever After, starring actress Sanaa Lathan. And here's a clip from the trailer.
Ever since I was a kid, my hair was everything. I had to be fixed. Only then was I perfect.
What do you think?
Perfect. Baby, whether you're high or
low. That's a clip from the trailer of the new Netflix rom-com Napoli Ever After, based on a novel by Tricia Thomas and starring Sanaa Lathan. And I'm here with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock-Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie, talk more about the premise of this film and how you felt about it.
I mean, it's basically the narrative of loving yourself and your natural self as a Black woman. And, you know, it's not something that we get even today a lot. It's interesting. I was talking to a colleague of Mark's and mine, Blair Kelly, yesterday about this film. And she was like, it felt like it was a couple of years behind itself. Like it would have made more sense a couple of years ago. And I can see that. It does have, it does feel like it's a little late to the party, you know, in terms of affirming your natural self, all the celebration that takes place on like Instagram and Twitter and Facebook, with Black women really affirming each other and natural hair and natural beauty. Has been going on for a minute, but even still, I think that this is, you know, it's a film that I pulled a lot from. I mean, because I think that one of the main themes, which is just being authentic and not trying to live up to some standard of perfection that is unsustainable, I mean, for anybody, but certainly for Black women, in that we can never be like we can't live up to that beauty standard that is, you know, in our culture. I think that's enduring. Like, that's never going to go away. So bring it on. You know,
and it is a rom-com after all. But Mark, what's your take? Because it has played to mixed reviews, and some of the critiques have been that it's a little late to the party.
You know, so first of all, I'm a big fan of Sanaa, you know, going all the way back to Love and Basketball.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were several moments in the film that resonated with me, you know, in ways that were humorous and not necessarily meant to be funny. You know, when her mother, and I'll just call her mom for the moment, Lady May, some folks will understand that reference, because she's playing Lady May just in a different context. But when she's talking to her daughter about staying away from the pool, right, and she falls in the pool, and it's not a question about whether or not she can swim or not, but she's going to mess up her hair. And how literally there have been, you know, 3-4 generations of Black women who never learned to swim not because they were afraid of drowning, but because of the relationship of chlorine to their hair.
Yeah.
And the fact that the film starts there, I think, is an important kind of moment to frame the film in a certain kind of way. When she's in the beauty parlor and she accidentally gets the relaxer and her hair starts to fall out, and I immediately, in watching it, say a cuss word. And then five other characters
in the movie
say the same cuss word right afterwards. I mean, that and you knew, you know, if you didn't have to be a black woman to connect to that woman. If you are a black man and you've had any relationship with any black women, you understood what that moment is. But you saw one come to terms with who she was. You also see the power of what hair means for black women's lives. And it is not given enough significance when we talk about who black women are in the world. When she's meeting with the folks at the end to try to sell this natural hair care product, and John Sally's character is like, well, why would we want to do that? It's almost reflective, I would imagine, of the time that it took to get the film done.
Right.
You know, this is something that this should have been done 8 years ago, but because someone might not have believed that it was a story that could be told and would find an audience, instead it comes out 3 years too late.
Yeah.
But that's also the kind of experience that black women are actually having in terms of trying to find products that helps them deal with their health issues and their hair and wellness.
Absolutely. Well, and it was very much present and relevant to Sanaa Lathan, the star, who talks about actually having, because she's got to shave her head, you can only do this. You get one take for that, you know,
exactly.
Or you got to wait several months to do it again. And of course, that's what happens in the film. But Sanaa Lathan talks about having to make that choice. Here she is.
I always kind of knew the character was going to shave her head.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while, I was like, oh, we'll just get a really expensive prosthetic.
Okay, we're gonna get a
bald
really good wig.
Because, you know, you just don't. I had a lot of hair, it was long, many, many years of growing it, and that wasn't even, I was like, I'm an actress, I don't have to do this. But the more I delved into the story and into the character, I was like, I will be doing this character and this story and what this means in our culture, in our world, a disservice if I do not shave my head.
There you go. Actress Sanaa Lathan talking on In This Room about her role in the Netflix rom-com Napoli Ever After, released in September. I'm talking with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. So obviously still a relevant topic.
Absolutely. I mean, that the scene where Sanaa Lathan's character cuts her hair, I mean, I think it's probably both triggering and liberating for, you know, black women who are watching the film, because it made me think of when I cut my hair to start locking almost 30 years ago and how I felt. I felt invisible. I felt all kinds of things that I had to really work through. My mom wouldn't even look at me when she first saw me because she was like, what did you do to your hair?
Right. Her mother's character in the film passes out.
Right. You know, so, I mean, it is, that's like real. And it is something that I think black women, even as we become liberated from perms and relaxers and all these, and weaves and all these things to reflect the white beauty standard with our hair, there's still a lot that you have to, you know, navigate and excavate when you are trying to be completely authentic, because you know that there's a whole world out there that is not necessarily and most likely going to accept you or even see you when you don't look a certain way.
Let us turn now to another new film, one that is still in the theaters, The Hate U Give. It's based on the Angie Thomas young adult novel of the same name, directed by George Tillman Jr., and I want to listen to a clip from the trailer.
Mama and Daddy says our life is here because our people are here. We got Mr. Rubin's Barbecue, Mr. Lewis's Barbershop, and Daddy's Store.
The high school is where you go to get junk, high, or pregnant. We don't go there. Williamson is another world, so when I'm here, I'm star version two.
Yo, those kicks are lit.
Basically, Williamson's star doesn't give anyone a reason to call her ghetto.
And I hate myself for doing it.
Until the weekend comes around.
I get those goosebumps every time.
What's up? Where you been at?
I mean, I know you be hanging with all the white kids.
Shut up. Yeah, when you're not
around. clip from the trailer of the new movie, The Hate U Give, directed by George Tillman Jr., based on the book by Angie Thomas. I'm talking with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Mark, based on that young adult novel, as you said, by Angie Thomas, tells the story of a young girl named Star Carter. But tell us more about the premise here.
This is a young girl who is with a first love who watches him get shot by police. You know, I call the character Star and a whole generation of African-American kids a generation of watchers. You know, they've come of age watching these brutal deaths of African-Americans and other folks largely on handheld devices. And in her case, you know, she had to see at least two times a girlfriend who was killed when she was 10 and now, you know, this close male friend when she's 16 and see that up close and personal, right? And it allows us to kind of work through, you know, this kind of rupture that occurs in her life when she actually has to deal with this violence, you know, in face-to-face in ways that's not mediated, you know, by you know, handheld devices. I bought the Angie Thomas novel for my daughter about a year and a half ago. My daughter read it over the course of a night. She carried it around in her book bag every day for about 6 months, constantly making reference of it. Right. It was, in fact, my then 14-year-old daughter who told me that they're making a movie about this. Mm-hmm. Can you find out more information? So I was fortunate to go watch the movie with her. And I was telling Natalie as we were kind of talking about the film before we came on air, there are at least three or four times which I was brought to tears in the context of that film. Because it actually asked us to deal with what these young folks are looking at and what we're expecting them to be able to negotiate, right? Given how random the violence is, right? How inconsequential the violence seems because it's so much of it. Right. And yes, you know, when you think about her background, this is a middle-class black girl, middle-class family. You know, father has given up a life, you know, working hard in the streets as a gang member. And the complexities and the contradictions of wanting to make sure we still live in black communities with black folks, but we got to send you to school elsewhere because we want you to be safe. And you find these moments where everything, it's too difficult to be able to balance these two worlds as a teenager.
I don't know that I can add anything to that. I mean, Mark just about said it all. I guess the you know, part of what I love about this film is that I got to go. In fact, I dragged my daughter with me to see it because she would have stayed at home. But she was engaged. It's a long film, too. I think it's over 2 hours. She never asked, like, when is this going to be over? She was with it from beginning to end. And afterwards, I was like, I think I'm going to buy you the book. And she was like, yes, please get me that book and the other one that, you know, was made into a movie that Amanda Sternberg stars in. So there's something about, I think, for young African-American kids and girls in particular, that really resonates with them, and that's powerful for them to witness, you know, to be able to see this character, this young woman Star, navigating these different worlds, what it means to fall in love at a young age, what that looks like, the violence, all the things that Mark talked about. I just think it's so invaluable for a young teenager to be able to see that in real time on the screen with someone that they look up to and admire as an actress. It has an impact. And I saw that with my own daughter.
And here's the author, Angie Thomas, who talking about the book itself and her own experience and how she brought that to this young adult novel.
At the time when I was in college, Oscar Grant had just lost his life in Oakland, California. He was an unarmed young black male who had a record. And at the time when his death was making headlines, more people were talking about what he had done in his past than the fact that he unjustly lost his life. And at my school, I heard a different conversation than I may have heard in my neighborhood about Oscar. At school, he may have deserved it. At school, he was in the wrong. But at home, he was one of our own, and we knew Oscar. We saw Oscar every single day. And the only thing I knew how to do at the time was write. So I actually wrote the short story that would later become The Hate U Give while I was a senior in college.
That's writer Angie Thomas talking on NPR in 2017 about The Hate U Give. We're on Back Channel today on The State of Things. Natalie?
Yeah, one of the things that I shared with Mark before we came on was the scene that I just totally broke me down and I didn't even anticipate it. And that's when, after Khalil's death, Star has a nightmare. And when she jolts out of her sleep, her dad is right there. And he knows what's going to happen, like because he's been through it, and also she's been through it, right? So it's so I think there's something about the humanity of how these characters are depicted, the fact that he, as her dad, you know, is just unconditionally there to help her get through this moment because he knows how hard it is. He even knows that she's going to throw up because of how traumatic, you know, that moment was. So it was something about that father-daughter relationship. And the fact that we don't get to see that right. often, you right. know, we really right. don't get to see that sort of intimacy between a father and a daughter where he actually dotes on her. Right. But he also is determined to get that Panther 10-point, yeah. you know, program in her and her brother's minds, you know, in a way that is just really empowering, you know, and uplifting in a very real and authentic way.
Just a quick word. I mean, Russell Hornsby is absolutely deserving of
yes,
all kinds of accolades
absolutely.
And hopefully an Academy Award nomination. We've seen him come up on the slow come up for a while.
That's right.
But the work he did in 7 Seconds, the work that he did with Denzel
yeah.
A few years ago, and of course with now this film, this is like a breakout moment for him. And it really is about that relationship with him and Star, Maverick
yeah.
and Star. It's amazing, you know, the idea, because, you know, you think about the Black Panther 10-point program, you know, that's one of the most, it's what Cornel West used to call radical democracy. That's mm-hmm. what that document is, right? As relevant in 1966 as it is in 2018.
That's right.
And to be able to see that in a mainstream film that's largely being directed towards young folks is really a powerful kind of moment.
And these conversations continue on The State of Things. We're on Back Channel with Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Stay tuned.
God is enough. Nobody completes me. Don't mess with my stuff. My cup is full up. What I got is enough. Nobody completes me. Don't mess with my love. Surely, 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 goodness and mercy shall follow me. Shall follow me.
This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal with me today for Back Channel, our recurring series connecting culture and context. Natalie's a filmmaker and a teaching assistant professor at NC State. Mark is a professor and the chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke, an author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. A new Showtime series from LeBron James called Shut Up and Dribble premiered earlier this month. And it gets its name from a comment by Fox News pundit Laura Ingraham. Let's listen to the clip from the beginning of the docuseries that sets up the context.
NBA superstar LeBron James is talking politics again, and this time it's R-rated.
The number one person in America is someone who doesn't understand the people and really don't give a f- about the people.
Must they run their mouths like that, LeBron and Kevin? You're great players, but no one voted for you. Millions elected Trump to be their coach. So keep the political commentary to yourself, or as someone once said, shut up and dribble.
That's Fox News commentator Laura Ingraham's comments about LeBron James earlier this year after he and other Black athletes spoke out against the president. The clip is the beginning of the new LeBron James docuseries on Showtime, and I'm here with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie?
I mean, it's just ignorance and racism spewing from Laura Ingraham's mouth. But what I love about what LeBron did with her comment, particularly the shut up and dribble part of it, is that he made a documentary
yeah.
that informs and educates about the long history of Black athletes and their engagement with politics and their willingness in a lot of instances, to make statements, either explicit or implicit, that let people know where they stand. And so she's, when Laura says, you know, keep the comments to yourself, like, you don't have any business making a political statement, she's completely unaware, oblivious of the fact that, I mean, and she... We don't have to go very far back in history to see people who actually put their whole careers on the line to make a political statement. Muhammad Ali, John Carlos, the list goes on and on. So I just love that LeBron turned that and flipped it and made something that I think is going to be really important.
Yeah, Mark, what about the power of this and the fact that these are voices that are collected together to create a context for all
this? This is the thing. There's a way in which we've never seen a basketball player like LeBron. We, of course, have seen political athletes before, black political athletes. We have never seen an athlete in the prime of his career so committed to creating spaces to address issues of social justice and inequality. And it's not about him. Right. It's about his willingness to create platforms, to produce content that deals with this. And you see LeBron now and you see Shut Up and Dribble, and you almost want the basketball career to just be over. Yeah. Right. Because you're imagining what he's going to be able to do and the type of content he's going to be able to produce over the next 20 and 25 years. And the fact that he started that conversation around this issue of the history of black athletes and in particular black basketball players around political. And it's an honest view, right? Yeah. So we look at Michael Jordan in a very honest kind of way for the faults and also what he represented to the culture.
Right.
You look at the kind of sacrifices that the Oscar Robertsons and Lou Alcindors, Hakeem Abdul-Jabbar, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, right? You find the story about who Chris Jackson was, right? And who he becomes when he becomes Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, right? And the fact that he gets punished by the NBA, yeah, right, for practicing his religion and refusing, to show allegiance to the flag. That's an important history that so many people need to know.
Well, and that LeBron sees his situation in context, because
yes,
there have been other athletes, yeah, who have, yes, understood what's happening to them and have spoken out, and perhaps in the language or rhetoric of the moment. But LeBron, remember, here's a guy who came out early. He didn't finish high school, for goodness sake, right? He goes to college. He's a premier athlete, one of the stars in all sport, who absolutely understands that this is a part of a much longer story. It's
absolutely
not the here and now. And as you say, in the prime of his career, decides, or maybe, toward the end of a career, but certainly while the career is still in full bloom, deciding to tell the story, including the story of Craig Hodges. You remember the story of Craig Hodges, 1992, the Bulls win the NBA title. They get to visit George H.W. Bush, trip to the White House. Craig Hodges wears his dashiki, right? And for which he was endlessly criticized, then slips the president a letter. And here's a clip from the docuseries of Craig Hodges reading that letter to H.W. Bush.
Mr. President, the athletes from the Chicago Bulls number 12, 10 of whom are of the descendants of African slaves, I have taken on the responsibility to speak on behalf of those who are not able to be heard from where they are. We have a sector of our population that is being described as an endangered species, i.e. the young black man. The question must be asked, why is the condition of the inner cities around the country in a state of emergency because of wanton violence, lack of jobs, or drugs? It is very important that the citizens of this great nation make a determination of what side of history we will be on in this most critical hour.
From the Showtime docuseries Shut Up and Dribble, produced by LeBron James, featuring Craig Hodges, a former NBA player, who was soon after that waived by the Bulls. What about this, Mark? Because nationally, things are going just fine. Well, no, we're in the middle of a recession. But I'm saying the heat wasn't on in the way it is now in terms of the rhetoric of racial politics, right? And here's Craig Hodges saying, oh, no, wait, let's not forget what's happening.
You know, Craig Hodges is an outlier, right? I mean, yeah, part of that letter was actually a demand for reparations to African-Americans before most even mainstream black folks were talking about reparations. This is someone who spent, weekends at the Nation of Islam Mosque, mm-hmm, listening to Farrakhan. He was also deeply involved with young folks, in the city of Chicago. The difference between Craig Hodges and Colin Kaepernick is social media. Because in many ways, Craig Hodges was punished the same way that Colin Kaepernick has had. Mm-hmm. But he didn't have the kind of platform to be able to tell his story and why that was the case. And he was absolutely blackballed out of the league. Sitting there in the film listening to Jerry Reinsdorf, who was then the GM of Chicago, talk about the fact, no, his skills had eroded.
Right.
And when the NBA is a league that is fundamentally premised, at least it was 20 years ago, that there would be two spots at the end of the bench for the two white guys who would never play, right? That was the NBA's affirmative action program, right?
And it was
never a question about whether or not he could play. I mean, he had just won the NBA. When he doesn't have a team, he goes to defend his three-point shooting championship from the year before. So the whole thing was quite ridiculous. But what he needed was for someone like Michael Jordan to close ranks around him, right? And the stars of the league were not in that place yet.
I was just going to say, I mean, it seems to me that Craig Hodges was so completely ahead of his time. And look, I'm from Chicago. I remember the Bulls. I went to see the Bulls play. I didn't hear anything. If I did, I don't remember about Craig Hodges and what he did at the White House. So, it was really kind of shocking to me to see Shut Up and Dribble, find out about this history, this story about this person that I remember watching play, just his appearance in a dashiki, said something to, mainstream sports fans or mainstream culture that was offensive enough to, completely shut him down.
And the bigger part of that story, actually, when it played out, was the fact that Michael Jordan actually boycotted it. Right. But not for political reasons.
Right.
He did not attend. He did not attend that particular White House gathering.
Yeah. What? Why?
He said he had met the president already.
OK.
This
is enough. Well, Michael Jordan does come in for as part of this. And as you say, when it was time to get support for the greatest player in the NBA at the time, Michael Jordan, it wasn't there. And here is Michael Jordan talking about that and his role or how he perceived it. And this is in the late 1980s.
When they think of Michael Jordan, I don't want them to think of that he's black or white. I want them to think of him as a person. I mean, I know that that's a lot to be asking from this society and the way people view things nowadays.
Do you feel sometimes that all of you is owned by some company or corporation?
A little bit. I feel that I've reached my limits in endorsements.
Arch, there it is, an interview with Michael Jordan featured in the three-part Showtime docuseries Shut Up and Dribble, produced by LeBron James. I'm talking with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. I mean, it's interesting because he's got nothing to lose as a player. You would think they're not going to blackball Michael Jordan, but those endorsements meant something.
I was actually shocked to see that scene because I knew there was a way in which Michael was apolitical, but I didn't think that he was someone who thought of himself as post-racial.
Mm-hmm.
So you listen to that, and then you put that alongside O.J. Simpson's clip a decade earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not black, I'm O.J., right? There's not really a big difference. But again, for Michael Jordan at that point in time, who is the perfect role model for this kind of crossover ascendance, that Michael Jackson would achieve? I mean, that Michael Jordan would achieve. It was, in fact, O.J. Simpson.
And I think, what Michael Jordan says, it really underscores this enduring tension that I think exists between, at least a segment of the black community, the black population, and our athletes and entertainers. We want more. We want you to say something, to make to take a stand. And I think that we continue to struggle with to what extent are black celebrities responsible for kind of taking the political stance of the community on their shoulders and basically promoting it to the larger culture.
Let's answer that question. He's got that right? He's got that right to say, look, I don't want to get involved in this. It's going to mess up my business. And we are not a monolith, African-American people. And here's how I see it as Michael Jordan in my position. He's got that right, didn't he?
He has the right. But at the same time, I think about what I believe it was Angela Davis said a long time ago about how if they come for me in the morning, they're going to come for you in the evening. And so we really can't afford to not make a decision about where we stand on an issue, even as celebrities. And to me, it's really, I mean, Colin Kaepernick has so completely blown up this idea of I can't take a stand because I'm going to lose my job, because he has set an example that, I mean, we can't even debate.
Well, for good or ill. I mean, he lost his job.
He did.
And,
but
I mean,
he,
that's terrorism. You know, that's how terrorism works.
Well, right?
And that's why the Kareem part of this is important also, because when you hear the story about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, then Lou Alcindor, sitting out the 1968 Olympics, he didn't have a job yet. Right, and he took a political stance that could, in fact, at some point, keep him from getting a job.
And he continues to speak out.
It's Back Channel today on The State of Things. Talking to Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown, and I want to turn to our last topic today. The legacy of musician Roy Hargrove, Grammy-winning jazz trumpeter, died earlier this month, only 49 years old. Let's listen to some of his 1995 song, Roy Allen. That's just a little taste of trumpeter Roy Hargrove performing the 1995 song Roy Allen. Passed away earlier this month at the age of 49. Natalie, talk about your relationship with Hargrove, because you got to watch him up close when you were living in New York, right?
I did. I moved to New York to work with a woman who was managing the singer Diane Reeves and the jazz pianist Jackie Terrison at the time. And as a part of my job, I got to go and listen to music live. And at a certain point, pretty soon after I moved to New York, I heard Roy play, I think it was at Smalls or Village Vanguard, one of those jazz clubs. But, you know, what struck me about Roy then, and I didn't know him very well at all. I mean, we would see each other and recognize each other, but I certainly have not been in touch with him since I left. But he absolutely understood, like you talk about LeBron James understanding the larger context from which he springs. Roy Hargrove understood the history of not only trumpeters, jazz trumpeters, but also of jazz. And he was steeped in the bebop tradition, and you could hear it. And it was almost uncanny the way that he was able to reflect. It was almost like a wisdom of experience that he infused in his music. So he sounded like he had been playing much longer, you know, and was much older and more experienced than he actually was. But that was, you know, part of his brilliance.
Steeped in the tradition and somebody who is also looking forward and propelled
absolutely
many other
yeah
traditions.
Absolutely. I mean, he gets discovered in Texas where he's growing up. When Marsalis comes through, gives a workshop, hears him play. A weekend later, he's playing with Wynton on the bandstand. 3 years later, he's in New York, and he's now the star of this new generation of what they call jazz futures, with a string of hit records. And one of the things he talked about is that, you know, folks were coming to him by the mid-90s as this kind of hip-hop jazz thing was happening. And they were telling him then, you're going to be the one that's going to make this happen, right? So when he shows up on D'Angelo's Voodoo, when he shows up on Erykah Badu's recordings, when he does these RH Factor albums, right, which is this like kind of meshing of hip hop. You know, some folks hadn't heard Anthony Hamilton until they heard him on the first RH Factor album. He clearly was doing some amazing things. And, you know, there was a kind of swagger about him that I think made jazz accessible to a younger generation. First of all, you know, he's a little guy. He always looked like he was about
younger,
17
that's
years
right
old.
Yeah.
So I'm sure for young folks seeing him, there's kind of a boyish quality about him that also made him appealing. But there was that kind of also swagger about the music. And it's sad when you see somebody, you know, leave, you know, so soon.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, we're going to go out on a medley of tunes that he did with for Erykah Badu, D'Angelo, and Common, and we'll hear a little bit of that music and how he propelled the tradition forward. But first, let me thank you, Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke, Distinguished Professor and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies, Natalie Bullock Brown, filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Back Channel on the State of Things, produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley's our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia. Once again, Roy Hargrove. Were you the one with